is Dallas Finney, versus People of the State of Colorado, case number 2012-276. Court counsel ready? Thank you. Argument is set for half an hour for both of you, 50 minutes per side. Ms. Frary, you'll have to keep track of your time. A couple other quick housekeeping matters. Please tell us who you are, who you represent at the time you start your argument. And what I said earlier about IPAC still goes. That's our briefs, Westlaw links, and so forth, and the notes. So thank you. With that, we're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rebecca Frayway, registration number 20010. I'm a deputy state public defender, and I represent the petitioner, Mr. Dallas. And I think the issue before the court is a very simple, straightforward statutory interpretation issue, whether at the time of probation or enters a guilty plea to a complaint, the court is required to advise him of the consequences, the penalties that he faces at that time. And this is really an issue of timing because the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals held that the advisement at the time that Mr. Finney originally pled guilty, which was more than 3 years earlier, was sufficient to satisfy an advisement requirement at the time of the admission to the complaint here. And so what I want to do is I'm going to start with the statute itself, because I think the statute, the plain language of the statute, answers this question. And I think the analytical framework this court employed in the Abraham Allen case can be applied here to resolve this case. Subsection 1 of the probation statute says that the court shall advise the probationer of the possible penalties in accordance with 16.7206. First appearance. So we know there's an advisement required at first appearance. 16.7206 states that the court has to tell the probationer you have the right to plead guilty. And it's well settled that that is a unique right to a defendant. The defendant gets to decide whether to plead guilty or not guilty. But 16.7206 also says that the court cannot accept a guilty plea without making sure the defendant understands a number of rights not at issue here, and without advising him of the minimum and maximum penalties he faces. So the probation statute, just in subsection 1, tells a district court you have to advise at first advisement of penalties, and if a defendant decides he wants to plead guilty, you have to advise then too.
Then we have counsel, I'm sorry, can I interrupt you right there?
Sure.
As I read 16.7206.1 is prefaced with language regarding every person charged with an offense. And I'm curious as to how that works in your mind in this context where we don't have a charge of a new substantive offense, it's simply a violation of the terms of the deferred. So how does the rest of that then apply if we're not talking about being charged with a new substantive offense?
Well, I think what the legislature was trying to do was to mirror what happens at arraignment on substantive offenses, and it did so by specifically including a statute that relates to substantive offenses. When a defendant is charged, there is a first advisement, a Rule 5 advisement. Generally, there's not a penalties advisement because there haven't been charges filed. Then there's a second advisement when the complaint and information is filed. Then there's a third advisement at the formal arraignment. And then there's an advisement on the guilty plea. So I don't think it matters whether it's a substantive charge or an allegation in the complaint, because the legislature made a decision to include this specific statute in the probation revocation statute. And that decision, I think, reflects the legislature's intent that we go through the same sort of arraignment proceedings for probationers, like we do for someone charged with a substantive offense, absent a right to a jury trial and some of the more specific due process rights that someone charged with a new offense would enjoy. So I don't think that makes a difference. But I think it's important that the legislature chose to include that statute, because we know that 16.7204, also part of Article 7, says the rules of criminal procedure apply. So the legislature is telling us by including 16-7206, hey, courts, you got to follow Rule 11 when you're taking a guilty plea. And then if we look at subsection 2 of the probation statute, it tells the court again, you have to do an advisement before the commencement of the hearing. And so when you read the statute as a whole, it answers the cert question here. When are advisements necessary? First advisement, guilty plea, before a hearing. Now, the people argue that this advisement at first appearance somehow was sufficient to satisfy the advisement requirement of the guilty plea, but there just is no authority that an advisement then, when the circumstances are completely different, would suffice for an advisement at a guilty plea. Looking at the plain language of the statute, I think, shows the error of the majority opinion in this case, because if it's true that an advisement at the time of the original charges is sufficient, then all of this language in the revocation statute about penalties advisement is superfluous. It's meaningless.
Now, what is the consequence you're concerned about here?
Well, the consequence here was Mr. Finney's knowledge that if community corrections didn't accept him, he was looking at a life sentence in prison, okay? The district court, and I think it was an oversight by the district court. I think it was an error. If you read this transcript, it reads like a Rule 11 advisement, and he just forgot to mention the consequences of non-acceptance into community corrections. But that's huge in this context. Mr. Finney had a felony conviction go on his record that was going to be on his record for the rest of his life, and nobody talked with him about that. And he was facing a life sentence on that felony conviction. Nobody talked with him about that being a consequence of the decision he made that day to plead guilty.
Can I ask you, good morning, let me interrupt you. Was there a testimony at the 35C hearing that he didn't know that? Did he ever say that he didn't realize it? Because you used the phrase, nobody talked to him. Did his attorney advise him of that?
You know, there was no evidence of that at the hearing. It's at the 35C hearing. I know that in the state's brief, the state said there was uncontested evidence in the record of that he was continually advised. But actually, that discussion occurred during 35C counsel, defense counsel's opening statement. He was making the argument there was no penalty advisement, and the court interrupted and said, but oh, wait. And then the prosecutor got in on it and said, I filed this grievance, and I have a response here that says he was advising his client throughout the proceedings. The problem was, when defense counsel got on the stand and testified, nobody asked him any questions about that. So it's not in record. What defense counsel said is, I never told him that this was a consequence of his plea that day. It didn't even cross my mind. In fact, on cross-examination, defense counsel said the worst I thought would happen was that he would be waitlisted. So if defense counsel didn't think that a prison sentence was a possible consequence, it makes it really understandable then that Mr. Finney, when he got to sentencing, said, I don't know what's going on. I thought I was going to community corrections, and now I'm facing life in prison. So defense counsel never testifies at this 35C hearing that he continually advised Mr. Finney of what he was facing or what the consequences of this plea would be.
I asked a bad question because it was a compound question. I did a two-parter.
I'm sorry.
I was sustaining my own objection to my own question. So my question, the first part was, did the defendant ever testify, or is there any evidence that he didn't realize that was a possibility?
Defendant did not testify at that hearing. I think the allegation was made in the 35C motion itself, his position, but so, he did not testify himself.
So am I correct in understanding that that your position is that it's not that he didn't know, it's that he wasn't advised by the court?
Well, I kind of think it's both, but we don't really know what he knows because that's not in the record. But I think it's inferable from his surprise at sentencing that he didn't realize that was going to be a consequence. And it's clear in looking at the providency hearing transcript that it was never discussed. You know, no one ever said, boy, if you don't get into community corrections, this is what can happen to you. And that's the problem. He didn't know the other side of it. And, you know, even if his attorney knew, okay, even though counsel said, well, you know, I know he was facing a life sentence, I believe Finney knew. He didn't know. I think the court was obligated then to at least have a conversation with defense counsel and say, hey, did you talk about this plea paperwork you executed back in 2004? So, you know, I think this would be a different case if the prosecutor had mentioned the maximum penalty somewhere in that competency hearing. It would be more like the Gressel case I cited in my brief. It would be different if the court had referred to that original DJ&S paperwork that spelled out the penalties, albeit incorrectly in my opinion. But then there would have been some discussion. I think it would be a different case if the court had engaged defense counsel in some sort of discussion about the ramifications of not being accepted into community corrections, but that didn't happen. Right. And so I think that this is an easy question. The plain language of the statute clearly requires an advising to first advisement before a hearing and then a guilty plea. Rule 11 applies, and I think there's well-settled law in this state about what Rule 11 requires. And I think if you look at the record as a whole, which the court does, is required to do under the Lovell case, Mr. Finney wasn't advised of the penalties here. His due process rights were violated, and I would ask you to reverse the court of appeals.
Before you sit down, could I ask you to make just one step connection for me exactly?
Sure.
Following the chain of statutes, which I think I remember from the olden days, but I forgot all the connection.
Okay.
But where is the connection between the statutes and Rule 11? Because you're arguing expressly Rule 11, is that right?
Oh, okay. That is in 16-7-204. And 16-7-204, let's see here, says the procedure to be followed upon arraignment shall be in compliance with the provisions of applicable rules of criminal procedure adopted by the Supreme Court of Colorado.
And so it's the connection between arraignment and the rules that you're looking at, not a connection between a plea of guilty and Rule 11.
Well, but the arraignment rule, the guilty plea rule 16-7-206, that says guilty pleas procedure in effect. So if we're talking about guilty pleas, that's part of that same article, and the criminal rules of procedure apply, they apply in that context.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm John Seidel. May it please the court. I'm John Seidel, bar number 17633, and I'm representing the people here. We disagree from square one. We disagree over what the issue is here. It's not a question of statutory interpretation, although that is involved. The real question is, what is the consequence of defense counsel's waiving an advisement that's required by a statute? Now, it's our position that counsel can do that and did so validly because Section 16-11-206 does not codify a constitutional standard. Yes, it does use the words plea of guilty. Court shall require a probationer to enter a plea of guilty, but it's our position the use of those words did not reflect an intent to codify or put Rule 11, all of Rule 11, into that section. I mean, for one thing, if the legislature had really wanted to codify Rule 11 into that statute, it would have put all of what Rule 11 said in 1970. And
is that pretty usual in this criminal trial practice that attorneys waive advisements?
In probation proceedings? I really don't know. I would be speaking beyond my level of knowledge. I don't have statistics on how common that is.
Would you do that?
Because, for one thing, in this case, the record shows the defense counsel wanted this agreement for Concord because that at least gave the defendant a chance for community, being in the community.
Well, doesn't that just reflect he thought he had it wired that was going to happen? I mean, let's get to it. Let's get to Concord. I mean, it just sounds like it's, if anything, it's a huge departure from effective assistance to counsel. Unless there's something else I'm missing here, I don't understand why you'd waive an advisement. Maybe you just thought it was so guaranteed, let's just get on with the hearing.
That could have been one of the reasons. And, you know, ineffective assistance was brought up, part of the 35C, but it's not an issue here. The lower court, the Court of Appeals, resolved it by saying, if I recall, that counsel's decision to waive the advisement and seek the possibility of Concord was a reasonable decision. At any rate, I guess what I was trying to say was, her argument is, well, they used plea of guilty in the statute, but that by itself doesn't say anything. If they really wanted to codify Rule 11, they would have put all the Rule 11 requirements in the statute. For instance, in 1970, Rule 11B, you know, required an advisement that a person need make no statement, and if he does, it could be used against him. He has a right to counsel. If he's an indigent person, he would be assigned counsel, and so forth. There were five subsections. And also, in 1970, Rule 11C had four subsections dealing with advisements. What was the charge? Is the trial court must determine the plea is voluntary? That kind of thing. Instead, the General Assembly only referred to Section 16.7206, and that, as Justice Marcus pointed out, deals with people charged with an offense. Now, the opposing counsel says it doesn't really matter. It's the fact that the reference to the statute. Well, in my mind, it doesn't really get the other side very far. I want to look at 16.11.206.1, which is the subsection right before the one that we're talking about. It says you can't revoke a probation until there's an advisement as provided in 16.7.206. But then it says further, in the same sentence, insofar as such matters are applicable. Well, such matters as are applicable can't be the penalty advisement because 11.206.2 already requires that. Further, 16.11.206.1 doesn't say what standard we're supposed to use to figure out which of all the Rule 11 advisements are appropriate. Well, in fact, that's really the question here. They say it's a constitutional standard that determines what advisements are applicable in a revocation proceeding, but I say it can't be a constitutional standard. Why? Because 206, subsection 206.1 was enacted at the same time as 206.2. Okay? Both of those were approved on May 22nd, 1972. About a month and a week before Morrissey versus Brewer came out. So these statutes predated the existence of any due process rights that probationers had. And I refer the court on that point to the Gell case, where the court basically said there are no due process rights, there's no constitutional rights in revocation hearings, but there are statutory rights. It was in 1972 that our legislature said, here's some statutory rights, and then a month, 5 weeks later, Morrissey came out and said there's some rights that parolees have, and again, it was yet another year before Gagnon came out and said, yes, well, probationers have some due process rights also, but among those rights is not a right to a re-advisement on the penalty for the original underlying offense. And again, 16.7.204, that deals with arraignments. We don't have arraignments in probation.
Could I ask you just to state or restate your argument? Assuming we agreed that the connection with Rule 11 is too tenuous, would you explain your reading of actually 16.11.206.2 itself and then 16.7.206? And why those, just on the face of them, don't require an advisement to the possible penalty? at the time of a revocation?
Oh, I'm not saying that they don't require an advisement. What I'm saying is they do, but it's a statutory requirement, not a constitutional one. And here, counsel waived it. Okay, I'm not trying, and that's kind of goes back to my original point, which is this isn't really about statutory interpretation. It's really about what is the consequence of counsel's waiver. Okay, so I think that, you know, if you read, I'm not really contesting the interpretation of the statute in the sense of what the words are. It says there should be an advisement. And I think the legislature, when they used plea of guilty in that context, meant admit or deny. In fact, if you look at the reply brief, at page 8, the defense says, well, a guilty plea is defined as meaning an admission to a substantive offense. If that's the case, the legislature cannot have meant guilty plea to incorporate or a reference to shall require a plea of guilty or not guilty to refer to all of Rule 11 and all the constitutional due process requirements. You know, one of the arguments that the defense has made here is that there's no authority for the idea that the Rule 11 advisement that precedes the guilty plea to the substantive offense is sufficient. And I suggest that there is authority. In Holdren, which I cited in the answer brief, there's a statement by this court that a probationer, quote, is charged with the knowledge that a breach of probationary terms will most assuredly result in a revocation of probation and a subsequent sentence, close quote. And there's another case called Gonzalez, which is from 1977, and I think it was cited in the answer brief at about 16 to 18. And it said, although the rule, meaning Rule 11, requires the court to determine that the defendant is aware of his various constitutional rights, nowhere within its provisions is there a requirement that the court, during the guilty plea proceedings, again inform the defendant of the particular rights or matters set forth therein. So I think if you read those two cases together, yes, a defendant is charged with knowledge of what he's been told, in this case, six times about the ultimate penalty to be paid.
Which is jail for violating a condition? What is it?
The penalty, the sentence of which he was advised here was a possible prison sentence of two to life being indeterminate. He was advised of that six times over the course of 2 months, or actually a little longer than that, between July of 2004 and February of 2005, when he finally entered his plea. Now, I want to go to for a moment to the discussion that the court had with the opposing side about what evidence there was. I believe Justice Boatwright asked, well, what did the defendant say, or did he actually say he didn't know about this prison sentence? He did not say that. What he said, in fact, was, I don't understand how it is. I can't, you know, I thought I was going to get into Comcor, and then come Thanksgiving, just 2 days ago, they denied me, and now I'm going to prison for the rest of my life. How did he know that? I think he did know. Furthermore, there was a discussion of what revocation counsel knew and advised the defendant in this case. Well, as defense counsel pointed out, revocation counsel told the Office of Attorney Regulation, hey, I was advising the defendant all throughout this process of the possible prison sentence. Now, to be fair, there was an affidavit that revocation counsel filed with the OAR. He said something about I didn't advise him on that day, the day of the hearing or the revocation. But he either in that affidavit or in a later statement, he said, I was representing or told him all throughout this process of the possible prison sentence. Now, there was some question about, you know, why that nobody asked revocation counsel about this. Isn't that odd? Well, it's not odd, because the defense below in the trial court expressly said, we don't care about any of that. We don't care about revocation counsel's advisement. We don't care how, what the court advised. None of that's relevant. We're hinging this case on ineffective assistance. That's why there was no discussion of revocation counsel's advisement or the court's advisement, because it didn't matter below. So the evidence here is, it's either an admission by revocation counsel that he did advise on the prison sentence all throughout this, or there's a statement by the prosecutor that that is what defense counsel said, and that's a representation made by an officer of the court. It's not the best evidence, but then again, the defense basically said, that's not our contention. We don't care about it. In that case, how could you expect better evidence?
Counsel, can I get you back to go back to your waiver argument? Could you help me understand that? I mean, what precisely how is this waived?
If I recall how the record proceeded, I mean, the trial judge said, okay, we're calling this case, you know, what are we going to do here? And counsel said, judge, we're going to enter an admission to the plea of guilty. And then I think there was some kind of colloquy, and I may be wrong about this, but I believe that the court said, the court later, not at that proceeding, but the court later found, well, at that proceeding when I said, what are we doing, and you said you're going to enter admission, you waived whatever statutory advisement on the penalties was required. You'll just have to check the record. I don't recall whether counsel at that time said, well, will you expressly waive the advisement? I just don't remember.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I still am a little curious, though, regardless of how it happened exactly, what constitutes a waiver in that case? What are the requirements for a waiver and what were done there?
Well, when you're, in our view, when, well, first of all, the Court of Appeals, I guess, has already found that there is a waiver, and that issue really isn't before the court, but.
But just answer my question.
Yeah, I understand. Our view is that when you're represented by competent counsel, and counsel elects not to invoke a proceeding that is available to counsel, or ask for an advisement, something along those lines, and that advisement is not a constitutional requirement, then counsel's decision to not ask for that advisement, or seek it, remind the court of it, is a waiver of that proceeding or advisement in this case.
And let me just flesh that out. Is that because when you say statutory versus constitutional that you're concerned with, I mean, are you saying something like it only has to be not coerced and not knowing and intelligent, or are you just saying the defendant doesn't have a personal right with regard to it at all?
Well, being statutory, I guess my reading of the cases is that a waiver of a statutory right needs to be voluntary, but it need not be knowing and intelligent in a constitutional sense. And then when you're represented by counsel, counsel takes care of the knowing and intelligent part of it.
Okay.
If that answers your question, and if there are no more, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Seidel. Mr. Ferrer, we'll give you another half minute.
Thank you. I want to first address Justice Hobbs' question about, is it common for counsel to waive advisements? I think it's pretty common in the district court for first advisements to be waived, a Rule 5 advisement. When a complaint or an information is served, I think it's common for counsel to waive advisement on that, because that's something that can be done one-on-one with a client. I think it's common when a defendant enters a not guilty plea to waive further reading of the charges in open court and just set the case for trial. So those kinds of advisements, I think that they are waived by counsel fairly commonly. But I've never seen a case or heard of a case where counsel at the time of a guilty plea gets up and says, oh, we waive all advisement. And even if counsel were to say that, I think Rule 11 requires the court to determine that the defendant understands, whether that's a detailed conversation with counsel or whether that's a detailed conversation with the defendant.
I don't think counsel's statement, we're going to waive everything, is good enough for a guilty plea.
So, counsel, can I get you to follow up on our colloquy with your opposing counsel?
Sure.
So just in terms of this, I guess, a statutory violation, you agree with that?
Correct.
Do you think the statute does require the full constitutional provisions for waiver?
I do. Yes, I think this, I think Colorado statute does, and I think that's the distinction between Colorado and, say, federal law, or the Arizona and Maryland case cited in the reply brief, okay? Those jurisdictions don't have a statute that codifies exactly what has to be done. But yes, I think that we are much more in line with Illinois or Montana, and that there has to be a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver of the right. I mean, the due process clauses, federal due process clause was ratified in 1868, Colorado due process clause in 1876. Due process was alive and well at the time this statute was enacted by the legislature, and I am sure that they were considering this whole notion of due process when they were thinking about what to do with people facing revocations. And the way they worded the statute, the way they structured the statute, was to have it mirror the arraignment proceedings for substantive offenses.
And can I just ask you to respond to the argument that the U.S. Supreme Court hadn't said there was due process in probation? I mean, how does the timing of the case law support your argument?
Well, I think the due process clauses of the federal and the state constitution existed at the time that this statute was enacted.
But just not in their application in this instance, is
correct.
That?
And I think that this court, through its various decisions, and particularly like in the Loveall decision, was interpreting the probation statute, which says a defendant has gets a fair opportunity to rebut hearsay evidence. What does that mean? Well, in that case, there wasn't enough of an opportunity to do that, and that violated his right to due process. So here, Mr. Finney clearly is post-Morrissey, clearly had a due process right to be advised, and from P11 is, following Crim P11 ensures a constitutional waiver.
But the statute couldn't have incorporated something that didn't exist yet, and I guess your argument is that it did. It just had, due process hadn't been applied here.
Right, exactly.
Thank you.
I guess that's all I have. You have
about
question.
30 seconds. It wasn't added.
I'm sorry?
You have 30 seconds.
Okay. I'm sorry. The state says, well, Mr. Finney's statement at sentencing, now I'm facing a life sentence, somehow shows that he knew he was facing a life sentence back at the time that he pled. I disagree with that. I think he knew he was facing a life sentence because he got his pre-sentence report recommending it, and because he found out several days earlier that community corrections had rejected him. Also, the state's argument that an advisement...
I think you better sum up.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's going up.
I
didn't see that. I apologize. Thank you.
The case will be submitted on briefs.